Before I begin, something that will help me as the presenter know if any of you have tight schedules, meaning I can do this shorter, intermediate, or full. Shorter? Intermediate?
Full.
Full. Okay. Full means there's some video clips. The video clips are, they're educational, they're entertaining, and it makes it longer. If anyone's getting restless, I'll sense it, and maybe I'll just shut down because it's getting... Okay. The title is Spiritual Economics Part 2, because on a previous visit to this very room with all the nice technology in it, I did Part 1, and I'll summarize for you Part 1 in about 3 minutes. The term spiritual economics is not my term or a spiritual organization's term. It's a term that economists that have been studying economics since the post-war era, when America's economy went kaboom, started exploding. So they had all this money to hire people in universities and other places to study what makes the economy grow, what's the impact that it's having on the quality of life, and so on. From those studies, a group of people put together a book called Spiritual Economics. And the summary of it is, it's not working. The quality of life is decreasing in prosperous third world countries where production is high, consumption is high, quality of life is going down. Like that's like a half an hour plus presentation, but studies of one professor Kahneman at Princeton University, who is in the field of psychology, won a Nobel Prize in economics for his study of how prospering nations are doing in the psychology department. And the psychology department is, they're reporting that they're less happy than in other parts of the world that's less prosperous. Economy, from the time that those studies began, the late 40s, early 50s, until the 2003, 2005, income doubled, happiness decreased. It's called the Enderlin principle. You can look that up on the internet sometime and see what it says. Happiness is decreasing as prosperity is increasing. So many, many studies like that. Then interpersonal, in Heidelberg, there's an institute that studies wars and conflicts between people, and over a third of the last 50 conflicts or wars between people have been over resources, because you need resources to have ramped up economy. And there's not enough to go around, so people fight over resources. And disparity between the wealthy and the poor has greatly increased during the period of economic boom in our nation, or the prosperous nations of the world. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. And it causes disparity in interpersonal or intergroup dealings. Environmental, the environment is being trashed and ruined. And you know all those things. So part one looks at the picture and says consumer economics needs another take, another approach. So in fact, at Carbondale this morning, I was speaking on this topic. So green economics, good but not good enough. Spiritual economics is their term, where spiritual economics, by definition, their definition is where the spiritual core, the needs of the individual, are the driving force or the determining factor of is economy successful, and successful means sustainable. See, the other way around. Not sustainable is not successful. Something that implodes upon itself is not successful. And that's what the current economic model is. So now we're looking more towards the sustainable future. I'll spend time on two main areas. This is before you get on the train, where's the train going? We'll look at two models of things that are not sustainable, energy and food. The way that energy is being used to run the machine today, economic machine, it's not sustainable. The food chain, the way that food is being produced today in the world of mass consumption, it's not sustainable, and we'll look at a spiritual alternative. That's where we're going. The very beginning of this is a little clip where, nobility is, they're going to look at the problems. And when you look at the problems and you have the list as long, you throw your hands up in the air and say, what can we do? The problems are too big. That's what these folks are saying.
It's everywhere we look, and yet we turn away. And we say to ourselves, it's too big. What can I do? But there's one question we cannot turn away from. Is this the kind of world we want to leave for our children?
Sure. This is Professor Rick Smalley, another Nobel laureate from Rice University in Houston, Texas. And his study is looking at the global problems, particularly at the energy problems, compared to the other problems that we read a lot about in the media, terrorism problem, pollution problem, water problem, disease problem, and so on. As far as he is concerned, the energy problem is that big of the pie of problems, because we use an enormous amount of energy to drive the economic system. And the primary source of energy is oil, and it's going to run out, and that's a big problem. So what do you replace the oil with is largely what people are looking at, rather than maybe we should have a system that doesn't demand so much energy. So John Wiley and Son Publishers, on the Twilight in the Desert, their estimate is that either in the next generation or maximum, our grandchildren will be without oil. But the founder of our International Society for Krishna Consciousness pointed that out in 73. What about the next generation? If there's no petrol, what are they going to do? Here's a little video clip. This is entertaining. About oil running out. Oil production going up. Thank you. the oil is the primary energy supplier in our present context. Here's an idea of how much oil globally is used every day. Excuse me. Yeah, every day. 14.4 terawatts of energy is used, and to produce that, it's a terawatt, it's trillion watts, it takes 80.3 billion barrels of oil per year to generate how much energy we use in 365 days. So what does that mean? 220 million barrels a day. What does that mean? It means if you stack Coke cans on top of one another, all the way to the moon and back, it'll go, it's 12 million kilometers. That's 30 times the distance from the Earth to the moon. The use of oil, that's a lot of oil. And it's a non-renewable source. Here's the 14.4 terawatts that was used in 2005. And this is the world population, 2005, about 7.5 billion. Projecting out over to 2050, the estimate is the world population will be at around 10 million plus. If the prosperous nations continue using energy at the same level and the world population increases without the rest of the world increasing their use of energy, but just looking at the population increase, we're going to need 45, this is calculating the developing nations, where wealth is now increasing, China and India particularly, they're using energy close to and comparable to the level of the use of energy in America and Europe. We're going to need 45 terawatts of power. Well, this is a study at NYU. We don't, the capacity of meeting our population increase with the needs for energy, if oil didn't run out, isn't going to happen. What to speak of oil running out? The present, this is statistics, President of Shell making a report to Congress in 1985, updated 2004. This is the current percentages of use of energy today, globally. Oil is big, so that the coal and gas and biomass, oil, coal and gas, big percentages of energy suppliers. And when oil runs out, we're going to have a big problem. And oil is running out. Here's a little clip.
We're moving from an era of cheap, abundant energy to an era of scarce, hard to get, expensive energy.
Keeping the world dependent on is important.
That's a prediction of worldwide catastrophe in 6 years, and then find out what this is all about. The demand is so huge, there is nothing that we can imagine to replace oil in those quantities.
The future is not in favor of the oil producers.
OPEC countries do not care about what might happen 20 years from now. These are politicians, they want more money. By that time, they are dead.
Okay.
more. So yes, we need oil.
This is not a prediction.
These are just little clips from a larger movie that's been produced to show what's going on with the consequence of oil running out. What are the other sources of energy? Alternative energy sources. Government, producers. I know a number of people that are, their job is developing fuel cells or producing biodiesel from algae, and one thing and another thing, because we have a huge demand for energy and the main supplier is about to run out. This is taken directly from Rick Smalley's PowerPoint presentation. It was online, I just downloaded it. His explanation of how, for example, nuclear power might be looked at as a way of taking care of the 14.4 terawatts. If there was one maximum scale nuclear power plant built somewhere in the world, every day, one maximum production is 1 gigawatt or 0.001 terawatts. And if one of those nuclear power plants was built every day for the next 42 years, not so likely, but supposing that were to happen, we would have 15,330 new nuclear power plants by the year 2050. Likely? Not likely. If that were to happen, it still wouldn't take care of the need for energy. I think I'm going to... This one is explaining or depicting how oil was maximum for a period of time. It was a luxury that just everybody had available, and in course of time, seeing that it's dwindling, it's causing a lot of concern. That's what this video clip does. If there's time, we'll do it again. Yeah. So, consumer economics, it's unlimited. Just consume, produce and consume unlimitedly. It's not sustainable. It produces uneconomic growth. That's the economist's terms. In other words, it doesn't help the system. It stresses the system. It divides people, the rich and the poor. I mentioned these things. It doesn't bring real happiness. Studies have shown prosperity, wealth, and more choices brings the opposite of happiness and well-being, and environmentally it's catastrophic. So there was a clip of Rick Smalley speaking of what happened to that one. There was a little clip, I don't know what happened. He was explaining how to get that 14.4 terawatts. So maximum through nuclear reactors. Of course, it has its problems because there's nuclear waste, and what do you do with that nuclear waste? They have problems with nuclear waste. I'll tell you the story about the problems with nuclear waste, one that I'm aware of. You can't go near the nuclear waste because it's lethal. Radioactive, and it will kill the person, so you can't do it. You have robots do it. They make robots that go and scoop up the nuclear reactive waste, put it in a metal container, seal the metal container. The robot takes the metal container, puts it on the back of a truck. The truck drives away, loaded up, and the robots unload the truck into a hole in the ground, and then they seal up the hole in the ground. Well, they found out at least one particular place was their dump site. The containers were leaking. And that meant the water table was becoming contaminated with radioactive stuff. This was shared by the robotics division
chairman from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He was the, whatever you call it, in charge of mechanical engineering department, the head guy, and overall so an interdepartmental robotics division. And so he went with his colleagues and the Department of the Interior and the Department of Defense and this department and that department, meeting, what are we going to do about this problem? They would meet quarterly and make no solutions. For him, he said it was obvious. You'd stop production because you can't, you know, hand a stick of burning dynamite to your children. You can't do that. No, they couldn't make the decision because there are too many vested interests in the money that was coming from that nuclear energy. You're saying, oh, we need the energy, we can't shut the plant down. So he quit. So it was just ethically unconscionable for him, etc. So nuclear, add them all together, it's a nice, I don't know what happened to the clip. Rick Smalley's thing was because he's now deceased, but his issue was solar power. Presently, the amount of energy reaching the Earth planet from the sun is something like 40 times what we need if we could harness it. So we need the technology to harness the energy of the sun. We got the energy we need if we have that, you know, supplemented by other things and other things. Maybe. Then the food system. Because we're in America, we don't so much feel the pinch because we're a prosperous nation and we have what we feel that we need for eating. But looking at the whole structure globally, it's a problem to feed the growing population of the earth. And the technology that's been used to ramp up production of agricultural products has its big, big, big problems, and that's what this is going to look at. It's not a sustainable system. The first slide is, a lot of this is taken from New York Times because a recent article, rather recent article, a year ago, they did a whole study on this problem, the food problem. So one of the things is it uses a lot of fossil fuel. Remember in that little video clip they showed McDonald's and the oil pump and saying actually you're eating oil because so much oil is being used in the production of the food. You're not literally eating oil, but you're, so much oil is being consumed by our present system that it's number two behind automobiles in the use of oil in our world today. So literally we're eating fossil fuels. Okay, this is a chart that you'll see several times, and different parts of the chart are going to be highlighted to help explain how food is produced today and why it's unsustainable. That's like the gist of what this whole section is. The way that it goes is it starts, of course, the fossil fuels up here run the machinery and the processing and transporting of the food, plus also all the fertilizers and pesticides. So you have this fossil fuel energy coming into the system, and then normally you think about, you know, agriculture as farms, but there's this whole where the farms get their supplies and the machines, and then there's the processing and the marketing of it, and then it goes to the retailers and over here to the consumer. But it's not like, you know, from farm to consumer. It's an industry. So we're going to look at these sections that are lighted up right now. Starting with crops, and then we'll go over to how they divided animals from where the crops were grown and had a different system for animals.
Thank you. The way we eat has changed more in the last 50 years than in the previous 10,000. But the image that's used to sell the food, it is still the imagery of agrarian America. You go into the supermarket and you see pictures of farmers. The picket fence and the silo and the 30s farmhouse and the green grass. It's the spinning of this pastoral fantasy. The modern American supermarket has on average 47,000 products. Now they're tomatoes all year round, grown halfway around the world, picked when it was green, and ripened with ethylene gas. Although it looks like a tomato, it's kind of a notional tomato. I mean, it's the idea of a tomato. There are no bones anymore. There is this deliberate veil, this curtain that's dropped between us and where our food is coming from. The industry doesn't want you to know the truth about what you're eating, because if you knew, you might not want to eat it. If you follow the food chain back from those shrink-wrapped packages of meat, you find a very different reality. The reality is a factory. It's not a farm, it's a factory. That meat is being processed by huge multinational corporations that have very little to do with ranches and farmers.
Now our food is coming from enormous assembly lines where the animals and the workers are being abused. And the food has become much more dangerous in ways that are being deliberately hidden from us.
And you've got a small group of multinational corporations who control the entire food system, from seed to the supermarket. They are gaining control of food.
This isn't just about what we're eating. This is about what we're allowed to say, what we're allowed to know. It's not just our health that's at risk.
The companies don't want farmers talking. They don't want this story told.
There's a voice like that is popular in colleges because, you know, hey, the underdogs. But it's not just a story. It's like the opening remark, in the past 50 years, how food is produced has changed more in the past 10,000 years through mechanization, industrialization, through energy, through oil, and it's hugely different. On the health side, 4 out of the top 10 killers in America today are chronic diseases linked to diet: heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. And it has to do with how the food is produced. It's no coincidence that in the years, national spending on health care went from 5% to 16% of the national income. Its spending on food went way down because, you know, there were efforts to make more food faster. I mean, there's a clip that will explain it, and I'll just say it quickly. Following World War II, in World War II, there were bombs that the technology used to make the bombs was changed to make fertilizers, nitrogen-based bombs became fertilizers. And then the pesticides came from
nerve gas. So the technology for one was used for the other, because with fertilizers you could ramp up the production of the land, with pesticides you get rid of the pests, you get more production from the land, but it created health problems. More production, but more problems. The Center for Disease Control estimates that one in three American children born in 2000 will develop type 2 diabetes. One in three. The public needs to know and see precisely what that sentence means. Blindness, amputation, early death, all of which can be avoided by a change in diet and lifestyle. So food production impacts the quality of life for people today. Here's that same message. After World War II, the government encouraged the conversion of munitions industry to fertilizers. Ammonium nitrate was used in bombs, and they figured out how to use that to make fertilizer. And the conversion of nerve gas, the same thing that killed people, could then kill pests to make better production on the land. The government also subsidized commodity crops, paying farmers by the bushel. Produce more, we'll give you, for every bushel, we'll give you some money, in addition to what you can make in the marketplace. Produce more. So economy, you know, profit-driven incentives made a big buy-in for those things that produce a problem. So now we're going to look at the agro impact upon commodity crops. Here's a little video clip. The future of food.
We used to be a nation of farmers, but now it's less than 10% of the population in the United States, and so a lot of us don't know what it takes to grow food.
Over 12,000 years ago, people began planting and saving seed. Agriculture followed, and civilizations were born. In China, thousands of varieties of rice were grown. Over 5,000 kinds of potatoes were cultivated worldwide. In the U.S. alone, more than 7,000 varieties of apples were grown in the 19th century. In the 20th century, the face of farming underwent a radical change. The manufacture of nitrogen-based bombs during World War I led to the development of nitrogen-based chemical fertilizers. Nerve gas, developed during World War II, was slightly modified to make insecticides. DDT was the hero of its generation. New technologies promised higher yields, increased food production, cheaper prices, and greater availability. By the mid-20th century, these technologies, along with new developments in plant breeding, led to the Green Revolution.
I think the people who first imagined the Green Revolution had good hearts. Lots of people are starving around the planet. That's small human things in human civilization. Their thinking was, if we could just systematize agriculture like we did industry in the 1800s and bring it worldwide, bring one system that works, we can solve the problems that people have long had with agriculture.
The next 7 decades saw a remarkable increase in production. Year after year, huge fields were planted with only one variety of crop. These monocultures created an ecological vacuum that insects and disease could exploit.
European commerce has led to some of the greatest agricultural catastrophes of mankind. In the mid-1800s, very few varieties of potatoes were cultivated in Ireland.
I'm going to check.
When they became diseased, 1 million people died. When the same potato blight attacked Peru, they suffered fewer consequences. Today, only four varieties of potatoes are widely grown. 97% of the varieties of vegetables grown at the beginning of the 20th century are now extinct. Genetic uniformity leads to an increased vulnerability to insects and disease. Farmers found themselves trapped on the pesticide treadmill. The more they sprayed, the more they had to spray. The increased use of fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides increased costs, polluted water, and created health risks. Then in the 1970s, Monsanto introduced Roundup. Because of its ability to kill most weeds, it became one of the most popular herbicides in history. In the mid-1990s, building on technologies that used gene splicing, the Green Revolution turned into the Gene Revolution. Capitalizing on the new technology, Monsanto genetically modified its seeds to be Roundup ready. Normally, Roundup kills anything green, but if the plant is Roundup ready, when it is sprayed, it doesn't die. Now the company that sells you the herbicide also sells you the seed.
A generation ago, farmers would seed a crop and use a herbicide when necessary, but often they wouldn't need to use a herbicide. And today, you have a crop that, right when it goes in the ground, is designed to be sprayed.
With Monsanto's BT corn, the corn itself is registered as an insecticide. This is because every cell has been engineered to manufacture BT, a natural bacterial toxin. If a corn borer eats any part of the plant, it will die.
And now that we have genetic engineering, we're not just, you know, putting chemicals, but we're actually industrializing the food at a genetic cellular level.
One of the most controversial aspects of the gene revolution is the patenting of seeds.
There was a very good reason why for, you know, virtually 200 years the patent office and Congress did not allow the patenting of life.
The right to patent is guaranteed by Article 1 of the Constitution. Food crops were deliberately excluded from patenting on moral grounds. Starting in the 1930s, plant breeders were given the right to patent their work. But the patent protection did not extend to the subsequent generations of seeds.
You know, clearly when you patent a tennis racket, let's say with a new sweet spot, you can describe that very accurately with the patent office. How in the world can you describe a whole plant, much less generations down, when that's changed and mutated?
But in 1978, Dr. Ananda Chakrabarty took the first living organism to the patent office.
Chakrabarty was an engineer for General Electric, and he created an oil eel microbe and tried to get it patented. And the U.S. Patent Office said, no way, we do not allow you to patent parts of nature. You know, if you have a tennis racket or a toaster, you can patent that, but you can't patent a part of nature. But General Electric and Chakrabarty were very insistent and took it all the way to the Supreme Court. One vote majority decision, they said you can patent the genetic engineered microbe. Interestingly enough, this oily microbe was never used because even though it did eat oil and oil spills, it apparently ate a lot of other things for dessert.
The floodgates were now open for genetic engineering.
The Reagan administration, they said, let's patent animals, and then human genes and human body parts. I think what the companies would like to say is, we are patenting the gene. And wherever that gene goes, we own anything we put in it. If it goes into a plant, we own the plant. If it goes into an animal, we own the animal. You might even say around the world, if it goes into a human being, we own that human being. There would be some constitutional problems with that in the United States. But they clearly would want their patent to follow the gene.
The issue of patenting life has never been voted on by the people or the Congress of the United States.
It actually means giving corporations and clout the power to own and control species.
While corporations were patenting everything under the sun, they were also busy in another area.
Starting in about 1995, the stock market was running up, and Monsanto was buying up the seed companies, and DuPont was buying Pioneer. There was this, basically, the U.S. pesticide industry bought the seed industry for all intents and purposes.
Monsanto spends $8 billion buying up seed companies. By the 1990s, corporations begin patenting not only GMO seeds, but seeds that haven't been genetically engineered. The only requirement is that they have not been patented before.
It's one of the wonderful things about what our government's done for years with seeds is trying to save seeds so that we can preserve biodiversity. What companies have done is gone into those seed banks, find the seeds that aren't patented, and patent. As long as they're the first person at the patent office, they get the patent.
It is estimated that Monsanto owns 11,000 patents.
Why would corporations do this? Because then they can take the one seed they want to use to replace all these seeds and will own the marketplace.
I hope you could digest what was being said there. But the pesticide industry bought the seed industry. I visited a farmer in Maine once, a dairy farmer. Nice man. We met him in Boston. He and his wife were on vacation. They came to the Boston Haymarket area, and they met some devotees, and they took a book, and they came to the temple. They, you know, because they're from Maine, they never had met anything like a devotional group like ours, and we just continued communication with them. So one time I went with a group, and we went and visited their farm, met all the cows. This is Sally, this is Sue, this is Betsy, and you know, they had names for everybody. And then he was describing, we're sitting together in the living room, and describing the role that he has played is that amongst the farmers, they're being squeezed, just like this is shown. On the seed side, the machine side, and the market side. And then the banks hold the mortgage. And it's like squeeze and squeeze, and they're working cooperatively together. So they're fighting in the government arena, you know, stop letting these people squeeze us this way. But as industry grows, they just squeeze and squeeze until the farmer says, I can't take it anymore, take my farm. And they put up a little light industry place in the housing that people that need to live in that housing. Very insidious. But the nature of what's being described here is also insidious, that so you genetically engineer the plant so that it's resistant to the insecticide, and then you sell the insecticide or the pesticide. Everything gets killed except the thing that you bought from them, and you buy the insecticide from them too. And so it makes big production, but it makes for a big problem also. The one that the sound went out, if there's one variety of potatoes, as happened in the Irish potato famine, maybe some of you from America know of that Irish potato famine. Thousands of people died, hundreds of thousands of people died because there was a potato famine. The one variety that they had had a blight, so they had nothing.
So they died of starvation. And you have one kind, you don't have biodiversity, and it makes it easier for the insects to come and, you know, do their life cycle, but you keep changing, you have biodiversity, and their life cycle is a natural de-pesticide, biodiversity. Well, that's going to come up in just a moment. I'm going to not do the whole, all the video clips of the meat industry. In part, it's educational, it's informative, but it's going to take a little time. There's a little clip called Meat Tricks, like where the meat comes from. And it's not, what they thought was that we've ramped up the crop production, let's figure out how to ramp up the meat production, and so we'll have farms that's just for meat, has nothing to do with, you know, any diversity, just more. Like, you know, a businessman might consider getting more out of your little piece of land over here. So they set them up, but over a period of time, it depletes everything. It's extremely cruel to the animals. The environment becomes terribly polluted, as shown over here. There's a great reduction of land available for crops for human consumption, and enormous amount of fossil fuels are required to keep it going. So, I'm not going to show this, just time-wise. But it gives the chain of how meat is produced in the present system, with the agro-industry driving it. So here are some of the problems. Health and environment. Again, this is from that New York Times article. Factory farms are now one of America's biggest sources of pollution. As Wendell Berry has tartly observed, to take animals off farms and put them on feedlots is to take an elegant solution, that is, by the waste from the animals, it provides a natural fertilizer for the land. Or you remove that, and now you have another problem. You have to have some other kind of fertilizer, so it becomes petrol fertilizer, and you have pollution on the feedlots. The former problem is remedied with fossil fuel fertilizer, the latter isn't remedied, not at all. Health, recent study, March 2009. The study of more than 500,000 middle-aged and elderly Americans found that those who consumed the equivalent of about a small hamburger every day were more than 30% likely to die during the 10 years that followed, mostly from heart disease and cancer. On the ethical side, the worldwide number of animals killed for food in 2000 was about 45 billion. Breakdown is, well, chickens, ducks, turkey, and geese, 42.7 billion, this is an annual figure, 1.2 billion pigs, 745 million sheep and goats, and 306 million cattle, buffalo, and calves. And there's that small countries where they don't keep those statistics. So it comes down to about 1,500 animals every second. And about 10 cattle every second. That's, you know, 24 hours in the year 2000. So, not a healthy way of looking at those that were in charge of, were given stewardship over. Alan Turing, this is the World Watch Institute from Heidelberg, has indicated in his writing, studying where wars come from, conflicts in the world come from. The richest billion people in the world have created a form of civilization so acquisitive and profligate that the planet is in danger. The lifestyle of this top echelon, the car drivers, beef eaters, soda drinkers, and throwaway consumers, constitute an unecological threat unmatched in severity. This is very quickly, just other people, thoughtful people commenting on the food production system that we have in the world today. Isaac Vasilevich Singer, how can we pray to God for mercy if we ourselves have no mercy? How can we speak of rights and justice if we take an innocent creature and shed its blood? I personally believe that as long as human beings will go on shedding the blood of animals, there will never be any peace. So, on the food production, crops and meat, food production, how did it happen? The environment becomes polluted because of consciousness that's polluted. This is now, we're going into the spiritual dimension of all of this. When people are blinded by money is the only thing, that's all they can see, that's all that matters, greed takes over and higher appreciation of the value of our life and the life of others is lost. It becomes a world of consumers, and more consumerism is the name of the game. However, you can get people to consume. And to have the consuming keep going, you need to have the production going. So some of the best brains in the world are making the system so that we have all the goods and services that you can come up with. You have to have good administration to make the whole system run. So you have nice institutions like this one, where people learn how to become good administrators. And you have curriculum to make sure that people learn how to do it. So here's the picture, where the capitalist is driving the machine called society, and what we want over here is lots of production. So we have to have people desiring to consume, you have the machinery to make it happen, and you have the executives and workers that make it go. But you have to have people that fill those spots. So you have to have nice education systems with curriculum that matches the need over here. So the capitalists give grants to people that are doing their research work so they can get the stuff needed for the people over here. Then you have people that are very, very smart that know how to make the machine go. So these guys end up running the whole system, where the intellectuals are working under the capitalists. But that's the Vedic system is just the other way around. You'll see another slide in a moment. So some problems have been pointed out. We want strong economy. We want healthy environment. We want a nice, balanced, and well-situated society. And if you look at those pieces separately, as it's now being looked at, this is the real winner. And if something happens bad over here and over there, we try to fix it. But this one has to keep going. And it's just, you know, one solution in one place creates a problem for the other place. Doesn't work, because in fact they overlap. Short-term goals with long-term problems. So, and conflicts arise between groups that are interested in this one, and this one. So, looking towards a sustainable model, there are other ways to look at it. There's some, like a Venn diagram, there's some overlap. This one overlaps with that one, and so on. So, there is some interconnection between them. Its benefit is it wants to see the perspective of looking to see where the overlap is and how one can help the other one is good. But the limitation is, still, this guy seems to win out, at least from a large part of society. And when you do have growth over here, it leads to depletion in the other places. And social inequities continue. So this is another model, the concentric model, that has become more modern. And we're going to add to this one to get the spiritual model, spiritual economics. But economics is a subset of what society's needs are. And society's needs are a subset of we live within an environment. So we have to look at how economy is impacting environment so we have a sustainable environment, sustainable social structure, so we can have a sustainable economy. That's more modern and progressive thinking. Education institutions are addressing this need, although still economy gets you know, the number one position often. It seeks to contain uneconomic growth. There's a problem though, because material hankering is still very great, and often because of that, society and environment get sacrificed. Conflicts between different communities of people within society and interest groups within society are still at risk. Here's the overall problem. Material solutions cannot be sustainable for a system that has as its basis a spiritual constitution. That's that picture that I explained to you from part one. The economist that decided, or a group of people like the one that compiled this book, where the name Spiritual Economics comes from. He was formerly an advisor for World Bank. His whole life was spent how to get money to the people that are making the world go. World Bank. He stopped working for World Bank and went a different direction. He became a spiritually inclined individual, practicing Buddhism of some type. But his picture is, we have to see the whole individual and our spiritual needs of the individual. And if you don't take a look at that, you're going to have an unsustainable model of economy. So this is the spiritual economics model, where all of the other things are contained within our spiritual well-being. When you see to the spiritual well-being, the others are naturally seen to. You leave the spiritual well-being out, and the others are going to continue to create conflicts and animosity. Spiritual well-being is the basis. It's universal. Doesn't matter what part of the world, what language, culture, race, religion. It's our basis. The outlook itself is non-sectarian. And it naturally, because this is dependent upon this, uneconomic growth is checked. And how can that be made possible in this world? There are models of spiritual communities, not just our organization, but a number of forward-thinking spiritual organizations are making attempts to have spiritually based, sustainable economy. Communities. Here's a definition. A community looking for economical, environmental, and social well-being that is spiritually sustainable, because the central focus is spiritual well-being. To live this way, this is key. To live this way requires a different value system than most people hold today. I shared this in one visit here before. I'll share it again. Something like this I presented at Penn State, and a whole group of students, about 40 students that attend one professor's class, he encouraged them to attend the class that I was giving. I didn't even know that he lived on the camera, you know, taught what he taught. He teaches for a whole semester the stuff that I just presented this past hour. You know, they get grades and understanding the whole thing. One of the students at the end said, you know, although we know all this stuff, like inside and out, because, you know, this is a course in this stuff, I don't think anybody in the class is going to change their expectation for prosperity. I want a high standard of living. And even I know, he used the example, the train is heading for a brick wall, and I'm not getting out of the train. He used that example. Or another author in the New York Times, no, New Yorker magazine, gave the example of you're the conductor of a train. You get a signal from some distant place that says there's a bridge over a big ravine and the bridge is out. Now what do? Put on the brakes. But instead, they're putting on the accelerator pedal, knowing what problems lay ahead. So, because they don't want to, this is, it's making a change in lifestyle where you have a value system that differs in the present value system. And it's tough because we're surrounded by a society that says, prosper. And prosper means you become wealthy. And wealthy means you have lots of options and lots of stuff. You can be generous, that's good too. Be charitable and help other people. But prosper, that's a value. And this says, spiritual well-being is the value. And from that spiritual well-being, necessities become less. Your expectations of finding happiness through material stuff becomes less. The happiness becomes more within. How do you get there? Human civilizations, this is our founder Acharya of our movement, writing 25 years ago. Human civilizations should depend on the production of material nature without artificially attempting economic development to turn the world into a chaos of artificial greed and power, only for the purpose of artificial luxuries and sense gratification. This is but a life of dogs and hogs. Strong. The secret of success is to take refuge under the protection of the Supreme Lord. Without His sanction, nothing can be possible. To make economic development by our endeavors on the strength of tools and machinery is not all. The sanction of the Supreme Lord must be there. Otherwise, despite all instrumental arrangements, everything will be unsuccessful. So there is a natural arrangement for sustainability. And it's described within scriptures, and from ancient times people followed this system of sustainability. Dictionary definition is to continue without lessening, or to nourish, or to allow to flourish. It doesn't mean, sustainability doesn't mean it's static, nothing changes. Our way of life may somehow change, how we dress and how we talk and so on and so on. But sustainable means it continues on over time without diminishing. And a sustainable community seeks to maintain and improve the economic, environmental, and social conditions, deriving its strength from sustainable sources. There are, again, a number of communities that are really focused on this. The basis, this is our model. We're going to look at, this is looking top, we're going to look from the side also. But in society, relationships with other beings is important. The resources that we need for our sustenance, that's important. The resource management, that's important. But above all, this is our relationship with the Supreme. And the relationship with the Supreme is the determining factor for all the others. That's where you have spiritual sustainability. It depends upon our relationship with God and natural orders of things that are derived from God. Here's the side view. Spiritual is the basis of the pyramid. And then the pyramid going up, we look at the environment, the systems, the ecosystems, the food and water, and the things that God supplies for our well-being, and how do we conduct our lives socially, interpersonally. And economy is resting upon all those others that are in proper alignment. It's not trash economy, like boo on economy. It's not, that's not the idea. But it's the basis is a spiritual basis, where you have a sustainable economy. Spiritual well-being, I'm going to breeze through this. There's three factors. Spiritual well-being, social well-being, environmental well-being. And I'm going to race quickly. Environmental well-being is very important. We don't do this. The greater the diversity of crops on a farm, the less the need for both fertilizers and pesticides. So rather than the one crop, maximize production. The sustainable model is diversity of crops and rotation of crops, so you have the balance of what you need just from the land that you're working with or your community is working with. And there's a natural relationship between the animals and the land. New York Times. For today's agriculture, to wean itself from fossil fuel and to make optimal use of sunlight, crop plants and animals must again be married. They are integrated. And there's a biosystem here. CO2 and oxygen and nitrogen and so on. If the system is understood and the nature of the arrangement is understood, there's a proper balance for a sustainable economic model. Well-designed polyculture systems, incorporating not just grains, but vegetables and animals, can produce more food per acre than conventional monocultures, and a food much higher in nutritional value. Like that lady was saying in the video, people have lost sense of how you produce food. Like, you know, if things ran out or oil runs out, what are we going to do? We can't just go to the supermarket and get stuff that comes from, you know, halfway around the world. There are people that are concerned about this and making steps how this polyculture and biodiversity, but to make can produce crops that people are going to need to survive in the next coming generations. But to have it stay on the sustainable platform, I'll repeat, it requires a spiritual basis. There's a study of a farm in Punjab where by rotation of crops, here it shows the eucalyptus crops and how they mix them with other crops, and they're getting 80 to 100% yield without pesticides, without fertilizers, just by this kind of conscious development of agriculture. A smart crop rotation is as ingenious a technology as genetically modified seeds. And you don't become dependent upon Monsanto or you have to buy their seed or you can't produce anything. And then you have to buy the fertilizer because it's genetically engineered, it has to have a fertilizer to go with it. Cows in Vedic culture have a very important role. There's reason for it. When the cows are in the pasture, they deposit cow dung. And the cow dung can be used for compost and make for natural organic production of the land. And when you have a cow that is valued, not just, you know, something that goes into the supermarket, then the crop production and the milk production makes for local consumption. The cow becomes an integral part of the community of cow production, or excuse me, crop production. And cow protection means feeding the braminical culture. Those of you from India, you know what that means. The use of milk products in the form of ghee for sacrificial performances by the brahmanas is necessary. That the increasing the quality of goodness within society and all divisions of society is a natural product of cow protection and thus elevation of society. Without protection of cows, brahminical culture cannot be maintained. Without brahminical culture, the aim of life cannot be fulfilled. I'm going to go even faster. There's a social structure for sustainability where persons work together, and when it's time for planting, when it's time for harvest and so on, everyone participates. There are communities that are based upon this model. The Amish have been doing it for centuries here in America. And I visited Amish farms in mid-Pennsylvania, and it's really wonderful to see the level of cooperation that goes on. Making those kinds of cooperative efforts where someone producing this and someone is producing that, and you help one another. It takes away the need for so much mechanization and the fossil fuel program. A decentralized food system offers a great many other benefits as well. Food eaten closer to where it is grown will be fresher, and requires less processing, making it more nutritious. Whatever may be lost in deficiency, by localized food production is gained in resilience. Regional food systems can better withstand all kinds of shocks. Practical. Statement 1976 by our founder. Just like in our practical life, we see that everyone is not born a scientist or an engineer or lawyer. Everyone is born innocent, child. And then he's trained up by the guardians. The government should see that everyone, as he is trained up, he is working according to his quality and occupational duty. Then there will be complete peace and harmony. That human society is perfect. Rather than seeing just simply how much money one can make and that's how you decide what your career is. It's a little exaggeration, but in some cases not too terribly exaggerated. A friend of mine was in law school at the University of Chicago. And when it came to graduating from law school, they had fairs where, you know, law firms would come in and you would see what's going on with them. His complaint was there was no preparation from the university to sit down with the students graduating and saying, you know, what kind of person are you? What kind of law would you like to go into? What would really resonate well with you as a human being? It was, if you go into this kind of law, you can make this much money. You'll have to spend these many hours and make these many sacrifices. That kind of law, this much money, these kind of sacrifices, and that, you know, it's just a dollars and cents thing, like that previous slide. Nothing to do with, you know, what's your nature, what suits you as a human being. Without being educated properly, the mass of people are following the footsteps of the vested interest by exploiting natural reserves, and therefore there is an acute competition between individual and individual, and nation. There's no control by the trained agent of the Lord. Here's how the educational system is presently working, where the intellectuals are under the capitalists. Here's the Vedic system that we're advocating. The intellectuals give guidance to the administrators. The capitalists are taking direction from the administrators, and the workers are helping everybody. Vedic training is, we value those that have spiritual vision. The term that you just saw appearing is Varnashram. Still, all the divisions of society are there, but who takes direction from whom? The other is, the present system is upside down. Capitalists are driving everything. But it should be those with spiritual vision are giving direction to the leaders, the leaders are giving direction to the capitalists, and workers are assisting all. This is the essence, where God is at the center, that's the spiritual well-being. There's enough of everything by the will of the Lord, and we can make proper use of things to live comfortably without enmity between men and animal and men or nature. The control of the Lord is everywhere, and if the Lord is pleased, every part of nature will be pleased. So putting God at the center, we have a sustainable spiritual well-being. With that also, the social well-being, with that also, the environmental well-being. And there's a method of accomplishing that. That's this previous slide, by devotional practices, hearing and chanting, studying of scriptural texts, worshiping. This is a video clip that I'm going to skip because it's in Hungarian. There's a farm community called Echo Valley. They have government support because they don't have separation of church and state in Hungary. The government sees what they're doing is good. They have a institute for sustainability. They're inviting professors from this division and that division and government leaders to come and talk together freely using what they're doing as a model, a sustainable agriculture. Because Hungary and Poland in years of Europe have been the breadbasket of Europe. So they've had a high level of consciousness about the importance of the land and how to use it. So the government is supporting those that can generate models of sustainability. They have a nice model of sustainability. Spiritual economics. This is a little video clip. We'll end with this.
Thank you.
The end. Made it. Thank you for being patient. Any thoughts or comments on what you saw? Yes.
From what you were saying, you could understand how the capitalist system of the society is acting. And capitalists does create a disparity between rich and poor. But as you also see, the societies where the strict capitalism is followed, it ultimately often leads to socialist structure, like what's happening in Latin America or what's happening in Russia. The socialist structure doesn't always involve the sharp input like one exploitation. It's somehow an equal distribution of wealth. Though there, the religion doesn't cook any class. Remember,
the last part I want to catch. Though what?
Though the religion doesn't. Yeah. A socialist structure can work very nicely, according to the words of Che Guevara, of course, that without any put of religion, means socialist structure can work and the exploitation can work without the input of spirituality. So, what do you think, Vince?
Are you favoring the absence of spirituality?
Well, I'm giving an alternate model. Like, we are saying that materialistic society is fine and the spiritual governance is, of course, equal distribution and all these things fine. But there's another type of economics, or socialist economics, where this flow chart of exploitation doesn't work in theory. Practice may be different. So, how the spiritual economics, which you say, is better than the socialist economics?
Okay. Than the socialist economics?
Yes. That's followed by whatever. Russia,
or
China.
Say,
Cuba.
Okay. The short answer is, our real identity must be acknowledged, and a real identity is that we're spiritual beings. That's like a direct answer. So, if I'm looking at everything is owned by the state, and the state is munificent, it distributes as needed throughout the land. So needs are being taken care of from whatever the totality of what is produced. So it's not, there's not vicious competition, it's benevolence of the governmental structure. Greed will invariably enter unless there's a higher attainment of spiritual satisfaction by default. Say it the other way. When there's spiritual satisfaction, such tendencies of exploitation are gone because the happiness, the inner happiness, is attained. We don't find that true identity of spiritual well-being and spiritual happiness by default, invariably, unwanted things are going to enter into the theoretical system. Of the government is benevolent, it receives, it distributes. That's the short answer. Now that's the platform from which this model is being presented. And let's look and see, you know, does the Che Guevara or does the Fidel Castro or does the, you know, the communist system in theory, what happens in practice? The human frailty is there. Now, is there not human frailty in spiritual organizations also? Yes. To the degree that there is attainment of actual spirituality, no. So that's the path. Another answer to your question, practically speaking, is this. Because I recently spent some time with the person from this Hungary Echo Valley project. The Hungarian government is very concerned. There are like three nations in the world that are at the top of the sustainability concern. New Zealand, Hungary, and Sweden. Why exactly, I don't know, but they are. So the government has actively sought groups of people that can produce sustainable models. They found this one is most effective over a period of time in terms of living up to their ideals as well as, you know, continuing to grow on a scale that they
their target goals of things that they want to achieve. They're off the grid, they have no electricity, and so on. They live by their values. How does it sustain? Their answer is the spiritual principle is what sustains and supports the whole system. Without it, the human factor enters. The fallible factor enters. The greed factor, the anger factor, lust factor, competition, spirit, so on enters. Even within socialism. Yes.
I guess I just had a question in terms of, so if you're, in terms of vexing that system advocated for, or people try to practice it, however, it seems that sometimes one might compete with people who are practicing capitalism.
How can you live together with people that are practicing capitalism when you're doing this?
How can it compete?
Compete?
How can it not be defeated, basically? Oh. And I'm talking from, like, an empirical even perspective. If you look at, like, historical examples, there are a lot of times, even in small group environments that I've observed, I admire the collective ideal to a large degree, and I've studied it extensively.
Good.
However, I'm not seeing it succeed in practice. So I guess my question is
it's a good question, a good challenge.
Yeah.
Theory and practice. How does it, in practice, sustain? Where persons are very dedicated by their convictions, they're dedicated to the principles. And two examples that I can think of from my own limited practical experience, I mentioned one of them, is the Amish. Through all of what's been going on in the past 50 years in America, they're doing the same thing the same way. Or village life in India. Those villages that they're still using the same system that generations and generations of. And they're very happy. Not feeling like we're missing out on five-star TV. If they go that direction, then they lose it. They lose their value. So when there's actual satisfaction, it can continue over generations. There's deep conviction, there's education and understanding, because in today's world, my experience is people are being asked or forced to ask the why question. Why this instead of that? The younger generation. Why this instead of, why do things the way that my parents did or grandparents did or previous people did? Why not this way? So there's understanding through education and deep conviction, then it can sustain over a period of time. And there are models for sustaining over generations. The children, that one of the tests is the children continue, not just converts, but the children continue happily within that structure. Others can also participate that aren't born into that tradition, but there's deep conviction in education. Therefore, we place so much stress on the knowledge that's within Bhagavad Gita and the basic texts. So one can understand the real identity is the soul, the real need is attending to the needs of the soul. And there's natural arrangements for that, for the well-being of the body and the mind within that structure. And your question is practically, does it, okay, theory, but practically does it happen? I've seen it happen. What I'm personally doing, there's not multiple generations to test it, other than going back to agrarian life in India. That I've seen. It's the same. My experience is entering into that situation. It feels like this is time is standing still. People doing the same things they did hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And they're very happy. They're very happy. They're very peaceful. Is it sustainable? Yeah. Withstanding the pressures of modern society, that depends on our, on the depth of our conviction. We have a farm community in mid-Pennsylvania. Our devotees that live on that farm community, they interact freely and regularly with the Amish people. And they're very warm people, they're very open, very, you know, from the heart people. They're not going to get in a car with us or, you know, make a call on a cell phone or use a computer and make a PowerPoint presentation. They're not going to do that. But they're very warm, loving people. And they're very accepting of what we're trying to do also. The tradition is different, but the principles are very close. With a great deal of respect and sharing, you know, here's how we do this, here's how we do that. You know, year after year, generation after generation, changing the ideas so that we're successful. It's, you know, we become part, they have become part of their community, although we have our own tradition, and vice versa. They come and cut some of the land, the hay, for their animals. And we have some arrangement for that. Sharing, and as a community, we'll share. Anything else? Okay. So it's dinner time or something.